Hello, and welcome to The Eclectic Vanguard. With me, Michael Brown. This is, of course, Radiolab 97.1 FM. Hello, everybody, and welcome to our second show, and it's quite a packed one today. We've got Luke Austin of the political commentary YouTube channel Dankpol joining us in 30 minutes to dissect former President Obama's criticisms of the Black Lives Matter slogan, defund the police. But in just a few seconds, we are going to chat with Boaz Trust founder and longtime asylum seeker advocate Dave Smith about how COVID is affecting the asylum process for many of the most vulnerable people in the world. I found the chat really interesting, so I don't want to keep you waiting for longer than necessary. I hope you enjoy. Hello, I'm joined by Dave Smith, a veteran of dealing with refugee issues. He is the founder of the Boaz Trust, which works with asylum seeker issues around accommodation, and also NACOM, which helps people with no accommodation to get housed. And thank you for joining us, Dave.
Okay, it's lovely to be here.
So one question actually is, has the coronavirus, because it's obviously something which has been in the news so much this year, has that had major implications as far as asylum seeking is concerned?
Yes, it has actually. It's had a number of knock-on effects. In general, it's been really difficult for asylum seekers, whether they're in accommodation or not, because being locked down when you already got issues with trauma and difficulties with cash to go and shop and stuff like that, that's just increased the mental health issues. And also because one of the lifelines for asylum seekers is the voluntary sector drop-ins that there are. And of course, all of those closed. So yeah. Their social contact has been reduced to a level that, well, we know what it's like, as British citizens. So you multiply that when you're talking about people who come from countries where social contact is so important and have been through trauma as well. So it's another level of mental health issues, I think.
Yeah, that makes sense. I'm curious, obviously, that's asylum seekers already in the UK.
Yeah.
The UK takes in some number of asylum seekers every year, obviously, more if there's a humanitarian crisis going on. And I would imagine, seeing as restriction, internationally, travel has been restricted a lot by the coronavirus lockdown, that would also have had an effect on individuals coming to the UK through the asylum process.
Yes. I mean, there's actually a big misunderstanding in terms of our asylum process here.
Okay.
Which mainly is that we take very, very few people through recognised schemes. So if you're sitting in a refugee camp somewhere in the Lebanon or Jordan or somewhere like that, and you're a Syrian refugee, you've probably got a 1 in 10,000 chance of getting put on the UNHCR scheme to get to the UK. So every year we take a few hundred, few thousand. I think they were talking about 20,000 over 5 years at one point by 2020. And of course, with the restrictions, that even those numbers they're not happening at the moment because they just haven't been able to get here. But the vast majority of people don't have any way of getting here legally because there are no legal schemes for them.
Yeah.
So they have to come illegally. They have to get across the channel on a boat or fly with a false passport or something like that, because if they didn't, they wouldn't be allowed in.
Yeah.
So that's how most people come. There's also a community sponsorship scheme now, where people in the community raise enough money to bring somebody over or a family over for a year. They have to provide, £10,000 or something that will fund the accommodation and various other things. So again, that is just beginning to happen again, but for the last 9 months, nobody's come.
I had actually heard, I think, that it's quite common for asylum seekers to have to enter the country they're claiming asylum illegally and then claim asylum while they're there. In some sense, is it not possible then that It's the coronavirus restrictions haven't actually had too much of an effect on the ability of people to enter the country because they've already been entering the country through.
The numbers this year, despite what you've seen in the channel, overall the numbers have reduced this year that have actually come and claimed asylum in the UK. There have been a lot more channel crossings. I guess maybe the police in France have been too busy to actually try and monitor what's going on. I don't know.
Yeah.
So I think there have been more opportunities to come that way, and people will take the opportunities that there are. So there have been more channel crossings, but overall the numbers are down, I think by about 10 to 20%. Yeah. Probably about 30,000 in the year, I think, something like that.
Obviously, I'm sure that you having worked for asylum organizations, have a great deal of compassion for these people. But to what extent do you think it's a security risk in terms of combating the pandemic that there are such a large number of people coming into the UK who, because you know they're coming in here illegally, there's not going to be any obligation for them to quarantine and things like that? Do you think that's a concern or not? I'm curious.
Well, as soon as they apply for asylum, the vast majority do when they get here.
Yeah.
You know, they want to apply for asylum straight away. Then all of those things will apply to them.
Okay.
I've been working with asylum seekers and refugees for 20 odd years. Mm-hmm. During that time, I think I've come across maybe four or five that were possibly borderline radicalized. One of them was a real, quite strict Islamic person who wanted everybody in the house to get up at 5 a.m. and pray and put on the, you know, the call to prayer at the top of his, as loud as it could go. Yes.
Yeah.
So, but the numbers of you know, there will be amongst the 30,000, one or two who may have inclinations toward terrorism. But if you look at the number of terrorist attacks that have been in this country, all of the people involved in that, and I can only think of one that was actually asylum seekers, they've all been homegrown.
Yes,
I have heard that. Yeah. Born here.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's not that we're importing them. We're actually making them, perhaps, by the way we treat them when they're here. So,
yeah, you know. That is interesting. So, yeah, basically, perhaps it's a matter of, because obviously, I mean, intuitively, it makes sense that people who risk so much to come to this country would not be coming to this country and then immediately, hating everything about it in the way that a radical jihadi would.
In general, they would be on the other side.
Yeah.
They would actually like Western values and want to be part of a Western society. So they're not likely to commit those offences, and certainly no more than the average Brit, you know. So I think it's some of the stuff that you hear is actually quite sad the way it's happening. And the environment at the moment is actually more hostile than it was 4 or 5 years ago.
Yeah, I can imagine that.
You know, just... Priti Patel has appointed this what's it called, clandestine channel threat commander.
Yes.
I mean, just the title tells you everything you need to know about the fact we see terrorism and security as trumping human rights, really, and asylum. You know, it's all about keeping people out, stopping them crossing the channel, sending them back, making it look like we're being tough. And, you know, that's what it's about.
I'm interested, actually, on the subject of the, I guess, religious persuasion of asylum seekers. We've spoken before, and the last time we spoke, one of the topics was how many Christian refugees and asylum seekers from the Middle East in particular, obviously places like Pakistan, you know, there's been some news recently about Pakistan becoming more radical. How many Christian refugees get sent away? And I guess the first point there would be, do you think that's a strong indication that this isn't really about, theological concerns over the radical tenets of a particular religion, but rather about keeping out vulnerable people, whatever religion they are, because so many of them being rejected? And, I guess that, but also, do you have any other comments on...
We did some work a couple of years ago as part of a group called the Asylum oh, what was it called? Asylum Advocacy Group.
Yeah.
And we were working on religious persecution and the way that cases were dealt with by the Home Office. And I have to say that the people from the Home Office who were running the departments, the vast majority of them we met two or three, and they were really nice people, quite keen to get a proper training pack in up and running for the caseworkers. And that happened after about a year of work. But it's a 1 day course.
Yes.
So you've got a training pack, and you get 1 day of teaching on Christian persecution or religious persecution, because it wasn't just Christians, it would be Ahmadi Muslims and others as well, Yazidis and so on. So they get 1 day's training on that, which is the same as they get for LGBT and the same as they get for trauma counseling, so victims of trauma. So it's very little. And when you realize that the vast majority of people who are coming into as home office caseworkers now are fresh out of university.
Yeah.
And, unless the geography in schools has changed an awful lot, most people don't know where half these countries are, much less what's going on in them. So to have all that sort of information fed into them over a very short period of time, and then they have to deal with individuals from these countries, they're bound to get things wrong, and they do. Last year, it's still about 40% of the initial decisions that are overturned on appeal.
Wow.
Which is a huge number, really.
Yes. And obviously, you'd have to think it's, if 40% of the first kind of decisions that are wrong, maybe some percentage of the appeals which are not overturned are wrong.
Yep.
It's interesting, actually, because you brought up the fact they only get this day's training. I do remember you saying last time you spoke that one of the big concerns is that it's kind of a cumulative effect, where what happens is because these asylum caseworkers get such a small amount of training, and I think you also mentioned there was a very large, a considerably high volume of cases they had to process over quite a small amount of time. I can't remember the exact numbers you gave, but you were basically saying that this meant that quite a few asylum caseworkers would actually end up leaving the job relatively quickly because of the stresses of that. And that would mean they'd have to bring in more people, which would mean they'd have to get even less time and things would get backed up further.
Yes. I mean, I think I haven't heard much for the last sort of year, really, what's going on in the Home Office. So I'm a bit out of the loop, but certainly when I spoke to you, at that time, they were actually having to deal with one case per day. That's deciding somebody's future in 1 day. So that's all the original reading, the application that's been put in, reading that through, and it's the interview and the decision, and all in 1 day's work. And, that's really, really difficult. And I just don't think they have enough caseworkers and that there's enough training of the caseworkers. If there's a pressure on to complete this. There's no targets as such, as far as I can see. But that's because all the targets the Home Office have ever had, they've failed to meet. So they've just stopped having them now. Then at least they can't be accused of not meeting the targets. So it's been really bad, and particularly over the last sort of 9 months or so of COVID, because everything has slowed down.
Yeah.
And it's now got to the situation where cases have not been heard. More than half of those seeking asylum have not had their case heard, even initial decision, within 6 months. And a large number, well over a year. So not allowed to work. They're sitting doing nothing, really, particularly during lockdown. So the backlog is horrendous. And presumably that's why they're now putting asylum seekers that come in across the channel straight into these army barracks.
So there's
one in Wales and there's one in Folkestone, I believe, and the conditions there apparently are not very good. And the if you're fleeing something, you don't want to go into an army camp where there's barbed wire all around it, and that's the last thing you need, really. So there has to be a better way of doing this, but there's I just suspect that COVID and Brexit and everything else has just taken priority, and bottom of the list are asylum seekers.
Yeah. Reminder, you're listening to The Eclectic Vanguard with me, Michael Brown, on Radiolab 97.1 FM. Now back to the show. I just want to clarify, obviously you've mentioned these barracks. There was a huge humanitarian concern about in the border between the US and Mexico, children in cages and all of these abuses going on. Yeah. I just want to know if you're aware, have there been any confirmed cases of abuse and mistreatment at these camps?
I haven't heard about direct abuse. I have heard that that agencies, that people coming to visit have been turned away, voluntary agencies. And I've also heard that the actual facilities there are very poor and that access to medical care has been poor. So I think it's more a case of neglect rather than direct abuse.
Yeah, and I imagine these are, you know, surely, it sounds that the term you want to throw out is concentration camps. And of course, the significant thing there is we're in a virus, or one of the big things being thrown out is social distancing and isolation. And obviously, concentration is very much the opposite to isolation. So surely this is, there must be health concerns when it comes to the spread of COVID then.
Yes, and that's also true in... And one of the things that happened was that a lot of asylum seekers, including people who were street homeless, who'd been refused asylum, were put into these hotels temporarily at the beginning of lockdown.
Yes.
And what they actually did is they didn't give them any cash at all. So their normal £37 a week, they were not able to access that. They got food and toiletries and stuff like that given them, but they had no money whatsoever. And that's only been addressed in the last sort of month, I think. And they've actually got some backdated now. But for something like 6 months, the folks in there have had no cash whatsoever. They couldn't go shopping if they wanted to. They just had no means of having any sort of life, really. So, and one of the complaints was it was difficult to socially distance in there, you know. So that was definitely a difficulty, yeah.
Could you just put, I don't know if we've got one already, I hope we haven't. So have you put a number yet on how many people in the UK are in this limbo situation where they're in the UK illegally, they've applied for asylum and they haven't got a decision one way or the other? What numbers are we talking about?
That's a good question. I've seen the numbers, and to be quite honest, I don't remember, but I think it's probably in the range of, I don't know, 30, 40,000, something like that.
Okay, yeah.
But I'm not totally sure.
And surely, I mean, obviously what is being spoken about in terms of there being a massive backlog of asylum cases not being dealt with, this must be a number that's rising quite consistently.
Yeah. Yes, it is. And that's one of the issues is that... I worked for NACOM, the No Accommodation Network, and our member organisations have sort of innovative ways of accommodating people who have been refused asylum, got no recourse to public funds. So there's all sorts of schemes, but over the last year, the number of people they've been able to accommodate has gone down quite significantly. They've had more nights of accommodation quite considerably, but less people because they haven't been able to move on. Their solicitors have not been working as much. They have, if they've put in a fresh claim for asylum, the Home Office have been sitting on it. The Section 4 accommodation, which is accommodation for people who have put in a fresh claim, has just not been available. So people have been waiting months for decisions on their fresh claim, so they can't move anywhere. They can't get out of the system, so the organisations that can't put anybody in their place. So there's this massive backlog, and it's just got, I guess, you know, everything has got crammed together. So so people can't move anyway, and I guess that's why they're now putting people in barracks, because there's no room in the asylum system, in the normal accommodation, because the people there haven't been able to move on. So
yeah,
Yeah.
I mean, see, one thing I'm wondering about is obviously, I think a lot of people would maybe surprised to hear and perhaps frustrated to hear who might be listening that these asylum seekers come to this country and then for potentially years, they are unable to work. They're not allowed to work. And something I'm wondering is what is the effect after, you know, their asylum case gets accepted, assuming it does, because presumably if you've, I can imagine that if you've been living in a country and you've not been able to work the whole time you're there, you've not been able to really establish yourself in any way because the whole time that your case has been in limbo, you've just been kind of confined to a very, let's say, just limited existence. Does that have deleterious effects in terms of getting a job?
That's absolutely true. I mean, a lot of asylum seekers do get involved as much as they can in voluntary work and so on. And apart from anything else, it helps because they manage to get a bus ticket or two out of it or a meal, you know. So that helps. But so generally, the vast majority actually want to contribute but can't. Yeah. They're not allowed to. So until they get their refugee status, they can't apply for jobs. But when they get their status, they have 4 weeks to move out of their accommodation and find somewhere else. Now, if you're not familiar with the system, even with the best will in the world, and the Home Office have made some improvements in the system now, so, you know, people will get their biometric cards earlier than they would have done before, and generally their national insurance number will come along with that, so they can actually apply at the job centre. But you've got to deal with going to the council to see if you can get somewhere to live, which often that will be a place in a hostel initially, if you're a single person. And, you know, hostel accommodation is not great and you don't really want to be sharing with people that are drug addicts and so on. Yes. But the vast majority of asylum seekers are not. They don't have substance issues. So that's one issue. You've got to go and start applying for jobs. If you've managed to find somewhere to live, then you've got to furnish the place. and you're waiting up to 7 weeks for your universal credit to come through. So how on earth are you going to do that? You know, you cannot do it in 4 weeks, basically. So a lot of charities are pushing the government to extend that to maybe 3 months or something like that, that they can stay where they are until they can actually get somewhere else to live. Because even British people can't find anywhere to live in 4 weeks. Can they do it, you know? So that's really difficult. And if you've had an enforced period of non-activity in terms of employment, it often means that when it comes to looking for jobs, you can't go for the jobs you would have been able to go to because you've been de-skilled.
Yes.
You're not up to scratch with it. One of the ladies that I know quite well, I did an interview with her over a number of times. She was one of the people featured in a book that I wrote called Refugee Stories. Okay. She was a doctor in Sudan, came over here. Her case was thrown out. She was refused. She became destitute. She spent several years not being able to work. When she eventually got her refugee status, she was in no fit state to start training as a doctor. She said that her mind had sort of gone, that she couldn't concentrate on things. And she found it really difficult to study. But in Sudan, she'd been studying and she'd been, you know, she'd studied in Russia and she'd been practicing for years. But the only thing that she can now feel she's able to do is be a medical interpreter. So, and that's such a waste.
Yes.
The waste of a person's talent. And there are people like that. There are people sitting in asylum accommodation doing absolutely nothing who are doctors in the middle of a pandemic.
Mm.
And that makes no sense whatsoever.
Yeah. Well, it's funny you mentioned sense because I was thinking, and I'm sure a lot of people would also be thinking, this is one of those situations where you feel like there must be a common sense solution and not just something, I mean, you know, it's easy enough to say, throw more money at it and all that kind of stuff. But it feels like this is a case where fundamentally the way resources are being allocated and the rules and mechanisms that are in place simply make no sense. So I guess having worked with this for as long as you have, what are just, I imagine only a few of the basic common sense changes you could see that should be made?
Well, there's been a big alliance, a big coalition recently called Lift the Ban. And that's basically the ban on working.
So
what they're asking for, it's not unreasonable, is that if your case has not been heard for 6 months, you then have the right to work.
Yes.
If you're in the asylum system. That seems eminently sensible to me. You know, people have been here 6 months, they've had time to acclimatise, and then they can get out there and look for a job. And why would you not want that? Why would you not want people contributing to society? You know, one of the ironic things is that when you get to when you get your refugee status, at that point you are told now you've got to integrate. Well, surely integration starts from day one coming into the country, not from, you know, a year's time. So a lot of funding was cut for ESOL classes. So it's really difficult to learn English. But then when you get your job interview, they say, why don't you speak English properly? You've been here 2 years.
Yeah.
They haven't been able to access that. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
So, that's definitely the obvious thing. You would think that the solution, the first thing would be make it so these people who are literally being forced to not work would have the opportunity to work, or, you know, at least get training, because they're basically just, I guess, forced to vegetate pretty much, and then blamed if they can't, you know, get a job, a skilled job or anything, four weeks after their case has been approved.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's
some of the most fiercely patriotic people in this country are people who have been welcomed here from other countries. So whether you look at the Polish people that came during the war, and or the Jewish people that came on the Kinder transport or whatever, you know, they've contributed so much to our society because they've been welcomed and because they felt that they were included. If you do the opposite to people, then you're not going to get that same effect.
Yeah, because I mean, obviously I don't want to, this isn't an attempt at fear-mongering, but you mentioned the idea that very few of these people have negative opinions towards the UK in terms of being radicalized, but you would imagine that if there are going to be any negative opinions, they're going to be fermented in this, you know, perhaps years-long period where these people are essentially forced to live as second-class citizens. And for a lot of them, maybe they think this is, you know, the same as the refugee camp in Syria or whatever.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, I guess, did you have anything else that you would like to say on the topic?
No, it just, I think just worth mentioning probably that during this pandemic, they, asylum seekers were given, I think it was £37.66 a week, basically, when they're in the system. And that was reviewed during the pandemic. And they increased it by 3 pence a week.
Oh, good. Small victories.
Well, I mean, who can... The Joseph Rowntree Foundation says that poverty is having less than £70 of disposable income after your housing costs and everything else have been taken out a week. Asylum seekers are given £37.70. That says everything about... Yeah. How we are treating asylum seekers in this country.
Yes. Also, you mentioned you'd written a book. Do you want to give that a more substantial shout out?
Yeah, it's a couple of years ago, but it all applies still. It's called Refugee Stories. It costs a tenner from Amazon and various other places. So just look up Refugee Stories, Dave Smith. There are 6,513 of me in the country. But
I was thinking that.
But it's Refugee Stories.
Yes, I didn't find your contact details just by Googling Dave Smith.
No.
That would have not gone very well. Anyway, yeah, thank you, Dave Smith. Really good to speak to you. Really interesting.
Thanks, Michael.
All right, bye.
Bye.
Very interesting stuff indeed. And just a reminder that you are listening to Radiolab 97.1 FM, and this is the Eclectic Vanguard, and I am your host, Michael Brown. We've just heard Dave Smith talking about the issues faced by asylum seekers in the UK and how they are being exacerbated by the current pandemic. But moving on, Luke Austin is the host of a political commentary YouTube channel, Dankpol, that's DANKPOL, who produced a recent video discussing Obama's criticisms of the Defund the Police slogan, which is a slogan associated with the Black Lives Matter movement. And there was a very interesting take from Luke regarding Obama's motives for criticizing the slogan, which I was curious enough about to invite Luke onto the show to discuss it. So I hope you enjoy hearing what he has to say. And I'm joined by Luke Austin, host of the political YouTube channel Dankpol. Thank you for joining us today, Luke.
Thank you for inviting me on, Michael.
And you've come on here to discuss. Obama recently made some comments, essentially critical of Defund the Police, a slogan heavily associated with the Black Lives Matter movement. And I was wondering if you could just explain in broad terms exactly what it is that Obama has been saying.
We uploaded a video recently which discussed Obama basically slating the Defund the Police slogan and saying it had bad electoral implications and, you know, Democrats shouldn't use the phrase, even though, as has been pointed out, no Democrat actually ran on Defund the Police. He just basically said it's not a good idea to go around saying defund the police. Quote, you lose people with snappy slogans like defund the police. So that was basically his assertion.
Just for context, what exactly does this phrase defund the police mean? Because it is something which I think many people have heard if they've been following the Black Lives Matter movement, and obviously Obama was critical of it. What does it mean?
So the Black Lives Matter movement, when it once again kicked into gear after the death of George Floyd, here's the thing. It had been going since 2014 with the murder of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri. Of course, George Floyd's death in Minneapolis sparked it up again. But of course, 6 years this thing had been happening, and you know, people actually now came to a conclusion that the key to stopping this kind of police violence, police shooting, or kneeling on in the case of George Floyd, unarmed black people, was to basically take money away from police departments in various cities like Minneapolis and then redirect it. So that's the key. It's not an austerity project. It's not like cutting the state down. Redirect this money into, you know, helping communities that are, you know, policed very heavily, because then, well, a better standard of life for those people in those communities, and of course they're not being shot or killed or even harassed daily by police officers. So that's what defund the police is. And it's a very good policy proposal, because if you look at, for example, New York City, I believe the NYPD budget is around $6.3 billion.
Wow.
Yeah, $6.3 billion. That is a lot. There was some crazy charts when defund the police was gaining traction back in the summer that just showed the massive amount of money that cities like Chicago, New York, Houston, Los Angeles spend on their police department, and then just the minimal spending on every other sector of the city. So yeah, it is a really big issue, and it would really help for a couple of reasons. We can stop black people being unnecessarily targeted by the police, and also we can improve the lives of those black people or any minorities or poor people in those communities, essentially.
So it sounds like this is very much contrary to what Obama is saying, which is that defund the police is just a slogan. It sounds like there's a real kind of political, almost philosophical underpinning to it of how a society should be structured, and that so it's not just a slogan, unless of course individuals are interpreting it as just a slogan wrongly. And you say that Democrats didn't even run on this idea of defunding the police.
Yeah, absolutely. In 2018, there was this movement around abolishing ICE, which is the American deportation force that, you know, rounds up immigrants and deports them to the countries that they came from. ICE has terrorized, you know, minority communities in America. And in 2018, the Democrats actually, you know, some of them ran on abolishing ICE. And it wasn't that popular either. I think 25% of the American public supported it. However, we get to the 2020 election. Defund the police, of course, is a phrase that has been uttered. And, essentially, no Democrat ran on that. No Democrat said, yes, I want to defund the police. In fact, you had Democrats specifically opposing defunding the police, specifically going out of their way to say, no, I'm not going to defund the police. I remember there's this candidate, Max Rose, who lost his seat in New York, who that's basically all his campaign was about, how he wasn't like AOC, how he wanted to make sure that the police was well-funded, and in fact Donald Trump was the one defunding the police. That was his idea, and he didn't do too well. He lost. But yeah, that's the thing. No Democrat actually ran on this, which is, I think, pretty important, considering that defunding the police wasn't a big issue for voters. If you look at the exit polls, the economy was a far, far bigger reason why. Basically, the Republicans picked up seats, did better than expected, and Donald Trump did better than expected as well.
So, okay, do you want to just expand on that? So that basically, the defund the police, Obama has claimed, I think you're right, what I'm right in understanding is that Obama basically said defund the police and perhaps other progressive policies like it put off the general public, and was the reason why Democrats perhaps underperformed considering who their opponent was. And it sounds like what you're saying is that it wasn't that at all. It was economic messaging that was the issue.
Yeah, absolutely. Here's the thing. The Democrats were expected to win the presidency, which they did, but by a narrower margin than expected. The Democrats were expected to win the Senate. They might still do that in Georgia, but it's going to be a 50-50 tie, with, of course, Kamala Harris being the deciding vote. So they'll technically have it, but only just. And they were expected to hold on to Congress, but the House of Representatives in Congress, but they might only have a 4-seat majority there. Mm. So yeah, they took a battering, really, when they didn't expect it. And the reason why, I think, is if you look at their economic messaging. Of course, it's no secret, we in this country and in America have a crisis, not just in terms of the coronavirus and the people that have died from it, but the economy. The economy has been ravaged on both sides of the Atlantic. We know it here, but Americans know it as well over there. And so, understandably, a major concern of Americans in this election was, wait, I have just lost my job, or I don't have any money to pay for rent. What can I do about this? And they look at Donald Trump. He provided stimulus checks to them back in March, federal unemployment checks as well. That was $600 a week. I think that was the key. Republicans could run on the economy, opening things up, which again might be a short term, quite a big health risk, as we're seeing now in America with so many deaths. But I think people were more concerned about that, thinking long term. And take Sarah Gideon challenging Susan Collins in the Senate seat of Maine. Susan Collins, quite an unpopular senator. People thought she'd lose her jobs as Sarah Gideon, the Democratic challenger. Susan Collins blew Sarah Gideon out of the water while Joe Biden won the state of Maine. And as we went through on the video, 23,000 Facebook ads Sarah Gideon posted onto Facebook, and zero contained the jobs or economy messaging. Zero. And that is, again, pretty crucial in a pandemic, in an economic recession. The same thing with Cunningham in the North Carolina Senate race, who lost while the Democratic governor won. The Democratic governor got 260,000 more votes than Cunningham. He was trying to win the Senate seat off the Republicans. And again, Cunningham didn't do any economic messaging either. So I think this is pretty key. And if you look at Joe Biden, Joe Biden, what was he running on? The soul of the nation, restoring America to what it once was. He talked a little bit about the economy, just a little. But, if you consider that Trump's dominant message was getting the country back, basically an economic populist message, if you will, and considering the checks that we mentioned before, you could see why he did better than expected, I believe. And that's why I do believe that Trump was helped by the coronavirus, ironically. Because he actually gave a lot of money to people, and not enough Americans blamed, him for the COVID death tolls.
I was going to say, why do you think that the Democrats have been so reticent to message on the economy and to make the economy a big focus?
Because they don't care. Mm. they don't care. And this gets to the heart of it. People like Obama have this affliction to try and make America, or make American politics rather, not about basically pocketbook issues, because they don't care. And I think you can see that by the voters that Joe Biden went after in this election. Trump, the biggest voters that Trump gained with were minorities, who were in poor communities. I mean, you look at like South Texas, heavily Latino community. Donald Trump said all Mexicans are rapists. Well, you know, they didn't really care that much, apparently, because Trump was had a strong economic message, and all of those voters, or like 30% of them, went to Donald Trump. And yeah, Trump gained in like New York City as well, which is crazy. He gained in like Philadelphia. You know, that's the funny thing about this attempt to overturn the election, blaming cities like Philadelphia and you know, Detroit and all that. Those cities voted for Donald Trump more than they did in 2016. They backed him more, which is, you know, kind of, I guess, kind of an irony there. But yeah, that's the thing. That's Trump can say all these things and win because the Democrats really don't care. They don't have that same economic messaging because they, I guess, they're just not interested. They're just not interested. And you can see by the fact that they went for the, I guess, suburban voters, voters who are more well-off, voters who are more swing voters. That's who Joe Biden targeted. And he was successful, just. But yeah, that's what the Democrats want to aim for, because I think, I mean, you ask a pretty big question there, you know, like, why do the Democrats care about economic messaging? I guess essentially they don't want to. They don't want to focus on it. They don't want to. And the bad thing about that is they leave sort of an open goal for Trump to walk in and the Republicans to say, we are the party of, you know, workers and the economy and all of that. And that, you know, hurt them quite a bit in 2020. And yeah, Joe Biden just skated by it ultimately.
Do you think that they're perhaps reluctant to make the economy a big focus and are more inclined to go after these moderate suburban white voters? Because with Bernie Sanders' successes in the primaries, and obviously he would have won had it not been for lots of people rallying around Biden almost at the last minute, really, that they saw Bernie Sanders as an existential threat to what the Democratic Party had really become since, I guess, you know, Bill Clinton.
Yeah, I think so. I think, yeah, Bernie Sanders was really, you know, turned the clock back. He was a Democrat from, you know, pre-Bill Clinton era. Well, a pre-Jimmy Carter era, to be honest, if we want to get a bit more specific. He was an economic populist. I don't really like that populist term because, you know, he was, it's just, well, you know, hey, guess what? People raising people's wages is popular. Who could have thought? Yeah. But yeah, that's the thing. It's that's completely different to what the Democrats had run on in the past. Even Barack Obama, who got so much success in 2008 and 2012, because of, you know, his economic messaging, then when he was in power, a completely different person. And they saw Bernie Sanders as someone who not only had that messaging, but had the convictions. And I think a key thing that they want to do is try and shift their voting bloc away from that, away from Bernie Sanders, and towards, you know, basically people who are more college educated, who live in the suburbs, away from, it's just further and further away from the traditional Democratic working class base that was alive in the 60s and 70s and even the 80s. There are incredible maps that we see when we see a change from basically 2012 and the 2020 election. So many more rural areas, you know, in the country voting for Republicans, and so many more cities voting for the Democrats, and that's what they like. Again, that's the change from 2012 to 2020, not 2016 to 2020. But yeah, the Democrats, essentially, that's what I think they're going for. And that's their, I guess, grand plan. Not to get too conspiratorial, but, you know, it benefits those Democratic politicians if they're catering to voters who don't care for Bernie Sanders' messaging. That's simply it.
Reminder, you're listening to The Eclectic Vanguard with me, Michael Brown, on Radiolab 97.1 FM. Now back to the show. So, I mean, obviously, you mentioned how Barack Obama won in 2008 and his messaging kind of shifted. Surely Barack Obama, the reason why he has these priorities of making sure that he focuses on rejecting these radical messages is because Barack Obama is somebody who's won elections before. He's somebody who's done quite well for himself, you know, a two-term president. And that this is just his advice for how the Democratic Party can retain power and be able to affect any sort of change at all.
This is the major point that the video that on DankPoll tries to make, is that Barack Obama is trying to deliberately slow progress to make himself look better. And essentially he sees Bernie Sanders, like the rest of the Democratic Party, as a threat, or his wing of the party, you know, the likes of AOC as well. And the difference is, of course, that the Democrats, like, say, Chuck Schumer, who might get primaried by AOC in 2022, or in the recent election, Joe Biden, or Pete Buttigieg, or Amy Klobuchar, the difference right there is that, you know, Obama's out of office, so he's not going to run for election again. So how come he cares about Bernie Sanders? Well, it's because he cares about his legacy. That's the key thing. Of course, all politicians care about their legacy, but Barack Obama especially. And you could look at what he did when he was president. You know, there's countless examples, which, you know, we could go through in a few minutes' time, that the video goes through as well. He was very, very keen to basically endear himself with, you know, the, I guess, the DC, New York Times, you know, consensus, an elite media class, you know. Journalists from those papers, Washington Post, you know, commentators on CNN, because they are the ones who would be writing his legacy. They are the class of people who would be, you know, basically saying how good a president or how bad a president Barack Obama was. And they have a very unfortunate, I would say, but very persistent ideology, which is bipartisanship, which is working with the Republicans. You know, that's a very key thing. And of course, the Republican Party, I would argue you don't want to work with them because they're a bit crazy. But that's what Obama tried to do time and time again. And this is the key thing. Now, well, that era has passed. Obama's term is over. He puts his feet up. Oh, look at this. Donald Trump is now president. Well, that's a kind of rejection of what Barack Obama tried to do. If, you know, many people have said Obama's led to Trump because he, you know, didn't do anything to help those voters in white working class areas. And I think that's true to some extent, but I think the thing he's most concerned about is probably Bernie Sanders, because, well, he was meant to be this, you know, game-changing president, and all of a sudden, well, look what comes after him. It's Bernie Sanders, this guy with an economic populist message. You know, the left wing of the Democratic Party is now, you know, is in a much larger position than they were post-Obama. And, of course, we have, you know, there's countless examples to show that Obama really didn't agree with Bernie Sanders on a whole lot of things. So if now that is the Democratic Party after Obama, well, it kind of shows how ineffectual he was. And that is something that, you know, he cares deeply, deeply about.
I think one example of Obama's legacy that comes to mind, I'm wondering what you think about this, is that Obamacare is something that a lot of people in the UK have obviously heard of. And I think a lot of people in the UK are maybe confused about the specifics of it. But obviously that was Obama's landmark piece of legislation. And yeah, I think I'm right in saying that if you look at what is the major focus of the American electorate right now, healthcare is still pretty far up there. And obviously in Bernie Sanders, you could have had the Democrats going into 2020, pushing for really a national health service like we have in the UK. So do you think that would be an example of something that might keep Obama up at night concerning the, I guess, integrity of his legacy?
Well, it did. It did keep him up at night. That's why he intervened to make sure that Joe Biden won the presidency, or won the Democratic nomination, rather. You know, he couldn't really help with the presidency thing, but yeah, he got Pete Buttigieg and Amy Klobuchar to pull out and endorse Joe Biden on the eve of Super Tuesday to give Biden the momentum, because, yeah, he was concerned about Bernie Sanders. Look, imagine if, you know, you leave office and you think you've done a good job. You know, all the pundit class in, you know, Washington, D.C., the New York Times, like, say, you know, he was a really good president. And all of a sudden, someone from the same party who was, you know, very different to you comes in and wins the presidency, or wins the Democratic nomination, and he looks like the future. Well, yeah, you're going to look pretty bad. And yeah, that's why, again, I think Obama, does he have an ideological opposition to something like Medicare for All? I don't know. I don't, that's the thing. I don't really think he does that much. But it's the fact that he did not back Medicare for All. He was against a public option. He was against, you know, he basically supported the privatized healthcare system. Obamacare was a fig leaf over how, you know, awful and horrible America's healthcare system is. And then someone comes in like, you know, Bernie, and basically says, hey, no, that wasn't good enough. What you did was awful. Let's do something that, you know, actually fixes the problem, well, yeah, he, again, his legacy is going to be diminished. And so that's why I said at the beginning, what he's trying to do is desperately slow progress. Let's talk about what we discussed at the beginning of this recording, which was defund the police.
Yes.
I mentioned in the video on Dankpol how defund the police must really rile Obama.
Yeah.
And the whole Black Lives Matter movement must rile Obama, because there was a black president for two terms in America, and that wasn't good enough. Now this racial justice movement is stronger than ever. And he could lean into that and say, hey, well, guess what? I helped it along. Look, I was one of the people that, you know, got this thing going. But of course, he really wasn't. He condemned the Ferguson protests when Michael Brown was killed in 2014. He thought that Colin Kaepernick kneeling wasn't a good thing. I don't know if you know about Colin Kaepernick, the American football player, who knelt in 2016. While he was still president, Obama said it wasn't a good idea. I think he said it was disrespecting the military, which is basically a right-wing conservative talking point. And again, this defund the police thing, him saying it's not a good idea. Yeah, consistently throughout his political career, he's tried to push back against, you know, the racial justice arguments, you know. And yeah, he is, as we talked about in the video as well, his, I guess, path is completely the opposite to someone like MLK. Completely the opposite. Who tried to agitate for change, who, you know, was unpopular with the white moderates, but got things passed. And so, yeah, I think Obama knows this. He must know this. He's a smart person, but of course, hey, he's got a legacy to save. And so, therefore, if we slow change as much as possible on, you know, Medicare for All or in racial justice, then people won't look back and basically question, well, the question will be, well, why didn't you do anything? You were president for 8 years. Why didn't you do anything?
A lot of people might have the perception that Obama did want to achieve things, but it was, you know, the Republicans who were preventing him from achieving what he wanted to achieve. To what extent do you think that's a legitimate appraisal of his situation?
Well, definitely the Republicans hated Obama. Definitely. That's the ironic thing about what happened in 2011 is, you know, Obama wanted to strike this grand bargain to cut Social Security with the Tea Party Republicans, and the Republicans didn't go for it because it wasn't good enough. But I can bet you if Obama had cut Social Security before the 2012 elections, he would have probably lost. Mm. And Romney, or he maybe might have lost, but it would have been a lot closer than it was. So yeah, just the Republican opposition to Obama, ironically, may have provided him a second term. But of course, yes, it's no doubt about it. Republicans hated Obama. You know, like I said, they were so opposed to him, they actually may have shot themselves in the foot. And throughout his second term as well, the Republicans held the House. They were insistent on making sure that nothing Obama passed, or nothing that Obama wanted passed. And that is definitely a problem, of course. We can't ignore that. But he did have a supermajority for 2 years, in 2008 and 2010. And he does control, you know, foreign policy in the United States. Of course, he's the commander-in-chief. Mm. He could, if he wanted to, stop the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. He invaded Libya, for instance, as well. Let's not forget that. And, you know, as president, he doesn't have to, you know, use Congress all the time. We talked about in the video the BP oil spill in 2010, something that devastated the Gulf of Mexico states in America. His administration, he has the power to launch an investigation into BP or press charges on BP. That was declined. He didn't want to do it. The Keystone Pipeline, for instance. He could have approved that or disapproved that, which of course would, you know, cause quite a lot of damage to the environment. I think it ran through like Native American places as well. People who I think historically have been quite harmed by the U.S. government. He didn't have to approve the Keystone XL pipeline, but he did. There's even the TPP trade deal. Do you remember that, Michael?
Oh yes, I do remember. And Bernie Sanders opposed it.
Yeah, Bernie Sanders opposed it. Donald Trump opposed it. It was this massive thing that was killed as soon as Trump won the presidency, which would, you know, it's basically, Trump described it as almost as bad as NAFTA. It's a bit different, but yeah, essentially giving a lot of power to corporations. He pushed that in 2014, 2015, 2016. I mean, if you know, of course he was hamstrung by Congress, but he could actually influence things in a major way, because he's the president of the United States, and he used his influence for bad things, in my opinion. So yes, you know, you could say he didn't get, for example, I think guns is the major issue, certainly in the UK, where he's bashed for not doing anything about guns. And it's true that, you know, Congress was very against any gun legislation, but even on that front, Obama could pass an executive order to ban assault rifles like Bill Clinton did in the 90s. I just don't think it's reasonable to say, well, Obama couldn't have done any better. The presidency still has a lot of power, and he had a lot of cultural power as well. He could sway things in a certain direction if he wanted to, but he didn't do that, even after he'd won his second term, when he had no elections.
I'm wondering, avoid any ambiguity around this, a lot of people in the UK, I think, have a positive opinion of Obama, and they view Obama as a pretty great guy. And I'm just wondering, because obviously I'm sure a lot of people will be listening to the things you're criticizing regarding, obviously, racial justice, economic justice, environmental legislation, trade policies, and obviously criticizing them. Do you think, in the simplest terms, that Obama was a good president?
Was he a good president? I mean, he was better than George Bush. Was he better than Donald Trump? Yes. Was he better than Bill Clinton? Yes. Was he better than George H.W. Bush? Yes. Was he better than Ronald Reagan? Yes. Was he better than Jimmy Carter? I don't know. Was he better than Richard Nixon? Yes.
I mean, so for a president, maybe he was good then.
I mean, the standard of presidents isn't that high. Look at all the things he did. You know, I think that's pretty. He was pretty poor, in my opinion.
I'm wondering about a slightly more thorny, but maybe more direct question. Do you think Barack Obama is a good person?
No. No. He's a very cynical person. I mean, we're talking a lot about, you know, the fact that he cares about his legacy. I mean, that kind of, I would hope, shows to you that, yeah, he doesn't really care about the everyday struggles of the American people. And to be fair, that's the case with a lot of the Democratic Party. He's nothing different in that regard. You know, I don't want to hate on the guy. I don't want to bash him. But unfortunately, his actions mean that, you know, that kind of thing is inevitable. And I wish, you know, I hope more people understand that. Yeah, this Barack Obama person, he's not somebody who should be revered.
So to take it back to the original point, which I think we've done a few times now, but so regarding Black Lives Matter and Defund the Police, your basic summary would be that the reason he's against Defund the Police isn't because of electoral reasons, because the fundamental reason why Democrats suffered electorally is because of their economic messaging, which is somewhere where Obama is in no position to talk. And that the reason he opposed this idea of defunding the police is because that kind of radical messaging would serve to make his own presidency look, I guess, retroactively ineffective.
Yes, exactly. And that's a very good sum up.
Well, thank you. Luke Austin from Dankpol talking about Obama's comments on defund the police and perhaps the ulterior motives for why he made them. Very interesting. Thank you. Again, that was Luke Austin from Dankpol. If you want to follow him on Twitter, you can at swegposter, that's SWEG_POSTER. If you want to follow me, that's King R. Farazon, KingArPharazon. I do find the topic of Obama's legacy very interesting because he must feel that it is under attack from all angles. You look at how his most famous piece of legislation was Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, and how that was not only attacked by Donald Trump, but also, in effect, attacked by the rest of the Democratic Party, because in the primaries in 2020, it was generally seen that healthcare is still a huge issue, even though Obama's healthcare legislation was at the time seen as this landmark piece of legislation, now it's barely even seen as a footnote in the wider healthcare discussion in America. And when you look at it from that perspective, it is a very interesting idea to suppose that Obama may want to stymie progressive causes because they will, in effect, retroactively make him look as if he didn't really do anything, because all of this other legislation had to come along at a later point, whether from Bernie Sanders or Donald Trump. And it is interesting to realize that Obama's legacy is still being written right now. And of course, Biden, he has identified himself as an Obama-style Democrat. Biden is going to play a big role in determining how Obama is seen retroactively. And certainly if the Biden presidency is a success, then Obama might be seen more positively. If the Biden presidency is a one-term presidency that's overall quite disappointing, that might be a big problem for Obama as well, and how people do see him. And it is ultimately nice to hear perhaps controversial voices like Luke's, who will come out there and say that Obama is just not a very good person, who was a very deeply cynical person, who didn't really seem to have any investment in achieving policy goals that would help people, but rather just asserting himself in the history books, as it were, as a president with an admirable legacy. And next week, I'm hoping to bring even more interesting conversations, even more challenging conversations. Big thank you to Dave Smith and Luke Austin, who are here today giving us these ideas to think about. And until next time, I have been Michael Brown. This has been The Eclectic Method. And this is Radiolab 97.1 FM.